Response of the Day. My name is Guido Lexkin, and this is Responsive Day for the 11th day of Nisan.
Today's responsive is from Shul Chatam Sofer, Hey, the fifth volume of the Chasam Sofer in the Choshen Mishpat, section Simon Kuf Ayin Zayin, responsive 177. Let's thank Rabbi Jack Abramowitz, David Hachhauser, the Orthodox Union for their help in making this year available to you. Chasam Sofer talking to some guy that he knows well, and he says, you no doubt got my letter from last week, but I'm going to write now to answer you quickly on the topic that we're going to talk here, and I want to make clear that the topic that we have in front of us is not ever fully clarified the tshuva. It's something about how to deal with the children of a man who has done something wrong. So the father is doing something terrible in terms of leaving Judaism and something like that. And the question will be, is something about how to deal with the children. The actual case is not clarified in the tshuva very well, but the issues that come up are very interesting issues of their own. But he writes also at the beginning of the tshuva, he says, I'm writing very quickly. Over Yom Afiyat Matzah, I started the tshuva on the day that we start cooking matzah. He doesn't say what baking the matzah for Pesach. Remember, this is the 11th of Nisan. The Gamarti biyom Erev Pesach Shizmano Bahul Ma'od. And I finished on Erev Pesach, which is always a very busy time. So I'm writing at great brevity, is his point. Now, what's interesting is that at the end of the Shuva, he dates it the 11th of Nisan. So I'm not sure if the 11th of Nisan was the day of the baking of the matzahs, and that's when he started the Shuva, and he just dated the start, and he finished at Erev Pesach, like he says. Or if he's referring to Erev Pesach, to 11th of Nisan as Erev Pesach, meaning he started it a few days before, because they bake their matzahs a few days before before the 11th of Nisan, because it takes a while to bake matzahs, so if you want to make sure you have matzahs for Pesach. And then he finished it literally on what we call Erev Pesach, on the 14th of Nisan. But in any case, he's writing it around then, and therefore the tshuva is somewhat shortened. Now his correspondent had pointed to a Gemara in Gittin, Memvav Amid Bet, where it talks about a man who sold himself to non-Jews. So the first time somebody sells themselves to non-Jews, it's our Torah obligation. It's the right obligation to redeem the person, even if he does it over and over again. But in the times of the Gemara, there were people who were doing that, and they were costing the community huge amounts of money, and they kept doing it. So the Gemara's principle became, if you do it again and again, we're not going to save you. So the Gemara there says, if a man did it, Podima banim achar mitat aviyam. Once the father passes away in his slavery to these things, then you go out and you make sure to get the kids back. Kol shekein, the Gemara says, halcha de'ika ketala, all the more so where there's a matter of life and death. So the man writes, mashma de'tfei chashin la ketala di'dei, me'atzalat banav shalitam uben anachrim. Sounds like saving the man himself if they're going to kill him. Meaning the case where we said, redeem the children was if the man passed away of natural causes. But the Gemara there seems to be clear that even though we wouldn't ordinarily redeem this man from slavery because he had sold himself into it several times, if there's an issue that they're going to kill him, then we would save him. So it sounds like the saving of the man is a more significant halachic concern or a communal concern, saving from death, from being killed, than even saving the children from the slavery. Now, the worry about the slavery isn't the slavery itself. The worry is, shalo yitamu ben hanakrim. The worry is that they will be so assimilated, they'll lose contact with Judaism, we will lose these souls to Jewish practice, and then if they never have children who are Jews, then we'll lose that whole family, that whole lineage, to the Jewish people. So the man writing the Chasam Sofer is saying, so you see in that Gemara in Gittin that the man's life himself is more significant to us than the children's assimilation, because the principle is you redeem the children after the father passes away of natural causes, and all the more so you redeem the father if the non-Jews are planning on killing the father. Right, you get him out of the slavery. If they're planning on killing him, you save him from that. So that all the more so means that that's the more clear value. If that's true, then in the case in front of them, and like I said before, the case in front of them is never fully clarified, but it's something along the lines of the father is doing something that is wrong of the father. He's abandoning Judaism in some significant way. My guess is that there's some issue of reform here, just because reform was such an issue for the Chatam Sofer, but I'm not sure. But their father is leaving Judaism in some way that we are no longer required to care about his life. So that's what the man's saying. Al chayav lo nachus. We in fact do not care about this man's life anymore. Umakino tovat shetei nafsho. And we would in fact in Beit Din, if we had the power in a court, we would discipline this man. There are certain things that a man can do. There are a bunch of them. So I can't know from here exactly which things the Gemara is talking, the discussion is talking about. But there are certain things that if a man rebels against the Jewish community and does what the Beit Din tells him not to do, the Beit Din has the right to discipline him. In their case, it was flogging. To flog him even until the point that he would die. So the man writing the Chassam Sofer says, well, if the father's in a state where we no longer care about his life, and the Gemara was clear that we care more about the father's life than the kid's assimilation, then all the more so here, that we then therefore, obviously here, we should no longer care about the kid's assimilation because we're not caring about the father's life. If the father's life was the greater value to us, and we no longer care about that, then apparently we don't care about the kid. So the situation seems to be something like, we're worried that if we do X to this man, he will not only resist us and refuse to adhere to the discipline of the community, but he'll take the kids with him, and the kids will be lost to Jewish practice in some way. And the question was, to what extent does the community have to care about the kids' assimilation? So most people would have said, I think this man is writing the Chassam Sofer because the general people's view was, you have to worry about the kids, and you don't do anything to endanger the kids' connection to Judaism. And this man was saying, I don't understand why we are talking about, why we're concerned about the kid's connection to Judaism, because we're in a situation where we don't care about the father's life. And it seems from that Gemara in Gittin that the father's life is more of a value than the kid's connection to Judaism. So if we're no longer caring about the father's life, we all the more so should no longer care about the kid's connection to Judaism. So that's what the man wrote, the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer writes, gently, but clearly and forcefully, he says there's a bunch of answers to your points. First of all, the case in that Gemara where the father sold himself into slavery, we're going to save the kids, Chatam Sofer says, I think we have to assume that that father is a fully observant Jew, meaning he doesn't even violate the Torah l'te'avon, right? The Gemara clearly recognized the idea that there are people who are just weak, who have such appetites for whatever, and everybody has their own particular appetite, their own particular weakness, their own particular vice. And when they're tempted by that, they violate the Torah, which says nothing. This is the important point about these people. It affects their halakhic status in certain ways, depending on what the vice that they're tempted by, that they yield to, is. It affects their halakhic status in some ways, but it's not like it leads us to doubt their overall commitment to Judaism, to service Hashem. It's just that they're weak, right? Everybody's weak. Let's suppose, for example, that there was a Torah prohibition. There may be, but let's suppose there was an absolute Torah prohibition against cigarette smoking. You knew somebody who, sadly, had gotten addicted to cigarette smoking. So when he or she sees a cigarette, they smoke a cigarette. So what are they doing? They're violating the Torah. So you could imagine a world in which we would say, well, look at that. That's a Torah violator. And that Torah violator clearly doesn't care about Hashem, and then move on from there in our discussion. But the halacha is not that way. The halacha deals with that person as what's called a mubaila te'avon. It's somebody who has, unfortunately, developed such a love of something, an appetite for something, not love in the emotional sense, but an appetite for something, such a connection to something that it's in, that he or she finds it impossible. That is what's called lemuantevon. This guy in slavery, he maybe is addicted to selling himself to slavery in order to get that money, and then he loses that money, and he does it again, and the community has to keep paying for him. But other than that, the Chassam Sofer says, we have no reason to think there's nothing wrong in his observance and his shmirat mitzvot. And the Chassam Sofer supports that from the fact that in the case in that Gemara there, they say that later on the news came that this man had started eating nevelot l'teavon. He started eating meat, non-kosher meat l'teavon, which means, for example, he's in slavery to Ludai, to people who are not Jewish. They have meat all the time. He doesn't have access to kosher meat in his master's household. He has no way to get it. So his only option is either not to eat meat or to eat this stuff, and he starts eating this stuff because he's too tempted. Then the Gemara says that the whoever was going to be poteh, whoever was going to redeem the children after the father died, he did it lifnim mishurat hadin. There already, it wasn't the halacha that you had to redeem the children. He did it lifnim mishurat hadin. Why is it lifnim mishurat hadin? So apparently the Chatam Sofer is saying, apparently the reason originally that we said that when the father dies in slavery of natural causes, you redeem the children, is because until then, he was raising them as full Jews, as fully observant Jews. And now that he's passed away, nobody's going to be able to continue their training and their education as full Jews, and he hasn't done anything wrong other than the fact that he sold himself multiple times to non-Jews, and that the wrong there, there's a couple of wrongs. One is that he's putting himself in a non-Jewish environment, but the more important wrong for our purposes is that he's causing the community to have to pay for his being redeemed from slavery. Torah actually says, the Cosmos Torah points out, Torah says the community is required to redeem this person over and over and over again, because the pasuk says, "Acharei nimkar gulat yelo." Even after he sold himself several times, you have to do it. But Chachamim have the power to say, we're no longer going to do that. And the reason the Chachamim say they're not going to do that is because they faced a situation where there were too many people doing it. It was really a risk to communal finances. And therefore they said, somebody does it over and over, we're not going to redeem them over and over. Because we can't allow that to happen to the community. That's a broad communal lesson. That's not our topic today, so we won't get into it. But something to think about is, you see in the Gemara that Chazal felt comfortable saying there are ways in which people dump their problems, their financial problems at least, on the community. And we are, as a community, have the right to, even in contravention of Torah law, we have the right to make rules to say, we're not going to allow you to force us to use up our communal resources on you. That, I think, is an important lesson. I think there are times that comes up today a lot, where there are people who create financial problems in ways that were irresponsible, and the community often feels like, oh, well, we have to respond, and I'm not convinced that's true for this exact reason from these kinds of Gemaras. So in that situation, though, when you have a guy who's fully observant, just that he sold himself to slavery, and he's raising his kids observant as far as the custom stuff for his understanding that Gemara, that's where we say the halacha is, once the father passes away, and we don't have any reason to think he's going to again cause the community these financial problems, then obviously we have to save the kids. And then obviously saving him, if they're planning on killing him, is even more important than saving the kids, because that's a life. Yeah, that's an actual physical life in addition to a spiritual life. That's not relevant to the question of if the father has done something wrong and he is therefore a Rasha, he is therefore categorized in halacha as an evildoer who really should be put to death or should be allowed to die, as the correspondent is saying to Chassam Sofer, the case that they were talking about, then you no longer have a Kal V'Chomer anymore. That if we don't worry about the father dying, then obviously we don't care about the kids assimilating, because the Chassam Sofer said something here that's going to be come up again in the Tshuva, and it's clearly his understanding. How could you imagine that? Meaning, the original logic was that the Gemara made clear that if the father was at risk, was in mortal danger, that's even more of a pressing need than the kids, than guaranteeing the kids' upbringing. So the man had said, so reverse it. If we have a halachic situation where the father's mortal danger doesn't matter to us halachically, then all the more so it must be that the kid's spiritual future doesn't matter to us. Chassam Sofer says, that's not logical, because the father's mortal danger stops mattering to us only because of actions the father took that are negative actions. But the kids haven't taken any negative action. If they're kids, like they're minors, they couldn't possibly take negative actions because they're kids, they're minors, they're not blamed for anything that they do. So therefore, the Chassam Sofer says, the logic falls down. Meaning, if it were to be true that you had a father who's the exact same kind of father as the Gemara's kind of father, but for some, I can't even imagine a reason, but for some reason, the halacha became that you don't have to care about the father's life, then maybe you could extrapolate that way back to the kids as well, in the logic that the correspondent had written to the Chatam Sofer. But Chatam Sofer's point is, but it's not the same thing. It's not like all of a sudden we don't care about the father's life. The father did something that means that halachically we wouldn't care about his life. And we think of him, he's going to question the next premise too, to whether we care about the father's life or not, even in this situation. So we'll get there. But even if it were to be true that we no longer care about the father's life, that's because of crimes the father committed. Meaning, let's suppose the father had committed murder, and therefore both the Jewish court and non-Jewish court are going to put this father to death. We wouldn't redeem him from death for that situation, right? Because he committed murder. But would that lead us to think that you don't, after the father's death, want to redeem the kids? Why not? So we say we didn't care about the father's life. But so what? We didn't care about the father's life. We didn't care about the father's life because he committed murder. How does that affect our calculus that we want to redeem the kids? So that's point number one. about why this should not be the situation. I mean, again, the correspondent was saying, well, if the father's a bad guy, he's a bad Jew, he's such a bad Jew that if we had a Beit Din that could enforce it, we would call him into Beit Din, we would discipline him, and unless he changed his ways, we would even flog him to death. So step number one, the Chatam said, and therefore, if the father's life it could be forfeit in front of us in a court, then we apparently don't care about the kids anymore either. So point number one, Chatam Sofer says, even if the father's life were in fact completely forfeit, and the example that came to my mind would be, let's say he commits a murder in such a way that's clear he did the murder, and therefore he's liable for capital punishment, why would you think that would change our calculus that we ordinarily say that once the father's no longer around to sell himself into slavery, that we redeem the kids to make sure they don't assimilate? What have the kids done that should change that calculus at all? I mean, you had this Kal Vachomer, but the Kal Vachomer was only dependent on a whole different kind of a father. Step number two, Chazal Sofer says, I think this is an important point as well. There are times when courts put people to death. There are times when courts say, you've committed a crime of such severity, such seriousness, you are being put to death now. That happens in halacha. But the example the man had with this man here, this father here, was not that he committed a crime that deserved capital punishment. He was acting in ways that violated Jewish discipline. I have to say again, I think it's probably he did things that reformed Jews, and reformed Jews in the early 1800s. Sorry, excuse me. I'm sorry, I saw that cough coming, and I hit pause, and then I accidentally, my thumb slipped, and hit the record again. So I apologize. I try not to cough on, you know, for posterity online. But that time I did. So, Reformed Jews in the early 1800s were a whole lot firmer than many, unfortunately, Orthodox Jews today, because they were chipping away. I mean, they were on the road, for sure, but they were chipping away at observance, and so they were picking these and these things. So those are the kinds of things which a Beit Din, if it could, would call them in front of them and would say, you can't do this anymore. And then, and they would say, tell us you're not going to do it anymore. If the guy refused to say he wasn't going to do it anymore, or let's say he had done it, And we called him in, he said he wasn't going to do it anymore, he did it again. Then you'd call him in and you'd say, we're going to flog you until you convince us you're not going to do it anymore, and we're going to do it. The halacha is you can do it in some situations, even to the point that the person dies. So the man writing the Chatam Sofer took that to mean, the guy deserves, we don't care about the guy's life anymore. So Chatam Sofer says, it's not true, there's no capital punishment here. For example, here's an interesting point. Take this same man, who the court could in that way put to death, if somebody else outside the court just decided to kill the guy, and there were witnesses to that, and they said to him, you know, that's murder. They said to the potential killer, that's murder. And the potential killer, let's say, but he deserves death because he's doing whatever it is. So they give him a shot. They say, that's not your right to do it. That's what the Beit Din do. You can kill him. It's capital murder. He says, you're right. I understand. And I'm going to do it anyway. That's murder. That's capital crime. He would be put to, the murderer would be put to death. Then you would bring the potential victim who was saved by these witnesses, or, I'm sorry, committed murders, never mind. But, or let's say he stopped, let's say if that guy killed him, he would have, if that guy stops, you'd call him into Beit Din, you'd discipline him, and if you end up killing him, you end up killing him. But that's not because his life is forfeit. Right? There's a category of people in halacha who we would try to arrange their death if we could. That's forfeit. But the guy we're talking about here is a mumma l'te'avon for a certain avera, and I don't think it's listed in the tshuva. He is doing something because he likes doing it. So it's true we could call that person into court and we could discipline him. And it's true that if he ends up passing away over the course of that discipline, we would continue to do it nonetheless. But that's because ulai ben kach yishma. That's because we think or we hope that this form of discipline will bring him around to observance. Now that's another issue that's very resonant today. It's part of, I think, what drove me to this tshuva, is that question of, when the Gemara assumes that certain forms of discipline are the way that we get people to change, so today, many people will say, well, if people don't change that way, you have to find other ways to get them to change. So that's, I think, an interesting question. If we had Batei Din that functioned fully today, would they say, you know, we'll try these other interventions to help this person change, or would they say these are the discipline that we give? And I think the answer is sometimes one way, sometimes the other way, whereas other people, I think, assume, no, it's always going to have to be, you're going to have to do the new thing that we today think works, and I'm not convinced. I think sometimes you'd call them in, you do use this discipline. If it didn't work, it didn't work. But the point is, even if you kill him, that's because then he'll be getting punishment for his sins as we're trying to get him to change his ways, and then it'll all be better. But that's not the same thing as saying we don't care about his life. If we don't care about his life, we would kill him, but that's not the situation here. So interestingly, the Chazal seems to be implying that there was a person who, in fact, the halacha would be that his life is forfeit, you'd have to kill him, then you'd have to maybe start talking about the kids, although we get back to the fact that, again, that'll be that the father did something wrong. So step number one is the father doing something that makes his life forfeit. Step number two is, his life isn't actually forfeit. It's that he's rendered himself available for discipline that might end up killing him. And then the third point is, and this is another interesting point of Chassam Sofer, let's even say that his life is forfeit. We would kill him in Beit Din. That still doesn't mean, says the Chassam Sofer, that if the man had sold him, let's say a man sells himself to slavery while he's to non-Jews, while he's in slavery to the non-Jews, he commits a crime which halacha requires and allows the Beit Din to kill him for. So let's say he violates Shabbat in front of two Jewish witnesses. They say to him, you know, if you violate Shabbat, you're liable for death. And he says, I'm doing it anyway, you violate Shabbat. So if you drag him into a Beit Din, the Beit Din would have the right and the ability, assuming that all of the details of court procedure were fulfilled, which is very difficult to do, Beit Din could put him to death. So now he's in slavery, and a bunch of non-Jews decide to lynch him and come kill him. What do we do halachically? So Chassam Sofer says, halachically, we save him from the non-Jews. We don't say to ourselves, oh great, we wanted to kill him in court, he's getting killed, good, it's all working out. We don't do that. We would save him. Why is that important for us? Because the whole premise of the question was, if we're not going to save the father, if the father's life is so important, we wouldn't save the father, and probably we don't care about the kids either. Because it's ever saying, it's not even true that we wouldn't save the father in that situation. We save even somebody who is, in fact, liable for the death penalty. We would save them from the non-Jews' plans to kill him, because that killing would not be the halakhic killing we seek. Then we'd bring the guy to court, judge him, put him to death, as the Torah tells us to, as a fulfillment of the pasuk of Bi'arta Harami Kirbecha, of extirpating the evil from among the Jewish people. But that would be a whole different thing. Very important point. Not all deaths are equal either. So that's a third valuable point, all of which points out that for all that these kids are now under the thumb of a father who's not acting perfectly correctly, and they are, you know, assimilated, they're in an environment where they're assimilated, the father dies, we would do our best to try to save the children, and all the reasons this man gave for not doing so are being wiped away by the Chassam Sofer. Fourth reason that he gives. Now we get an insight that the topic might have been that if you discipline the father in certain ways, he's going to take the kids with him and they'll be lost to Judaism. And so so the Chassam Sofer says, even if you told me that in fact there would be situations where we wouldn't redeem the kids from the non-Jews, we wouldn't save them from their assimilation, pushing them away, the Chassam Sofer says, I'm not sure why that's permissible. So the whole question, halacha, which isn't dealt with carefully here, so we're not going to do it, but the Ramah has a talk about if a man deserves nidui, if a man needs to be disciplined by the community with partial or full excommunication, and he says he's going to lead the kids away from Judaism, that we would do it anyway. So part of the discussion here is to what extent do we have to worry about that. So Chatzim Sefer says the whole reason that a full mumar, this guy's not a full mumar, somebody who's completely abandoned Judaism, we allow ourselves to put him in nidui, even if the kids are going to have a problem, Chassam Sofer says that's because of liyaser acherim. There are times when the community has to take certain actions, not because of the effect they'll have on the person who's being punished, because that person may already be, unfortunately and sadly, lost to our communal discipline. It's because of the effect on others. If they see that that person gets that reaction, right? That's, I think, a very important point to remember that also gets lost, right? If I react to X person's actions some way, there's the effect on that person. But sometimes, unfortunately, that person's too far gone, they won't feel the impact at all. But I do it anyway because other people around me, whether it's in my family or my community, understand that this is so terrible that this is the way we react. So too, you put the person in nidui, it might be that that nidui is not going to affect the mumar at all, but we do it because the other people react and we don't care about it, and the other people will get a discipline and have its effect on that person. Maybe it'll push them away further. We don't even care anymore about that person enough because he's already or she's already made themselves too far to be touched by it. But Chassam Sofer is worried about nafsho nikiyim, about we're going to now hurt these kids. And again, I don't know exactly how it's going to be. It's not going to be just by the fact that the father's getting disciplined. The father's going to then do something to take them with him further, and you're going to lose the kids. Chassam Sofer says, I think you have to worry about losing the kids, because to discipline this guy, mostly for its impact on the community, at the cost of the children, Chassam Sofer says, I think that's a real worry. Then he brings up another important, interesting issue that we can't do fully, but the Gemara talks about the fact, and this man raised the issue, that kol mitzvat aseh, shematan skara betida, Anytime the Torah mentions the reward for a certain positive obligation, so that the halacha is, the rule in the Gemara is, that a Beit Din does not coerce, is not required, is not warranted to coerce observance of that. So the man is, whatever the case was, they thought that was true here as well. So Chazal says, let me explain to you a little bit about that sugya. So Yerushalmi in Bava Batra, I think, that talks about the fact there's a puzzle that says, Eifat said you have to have proper measures. Eifat said that ki yelecha. And then the Gemara says that we, the community, appoints people like people of bureaus of weights and measures to go around and check that the measures being used are correct and accurate. Problem is, that's an example of matan skara betzida. The pasuk on the Torah tells you the reward for proper mishkalot, which I think is that you'll have blessings and bounty from Hashem. Pnei Moshe, on that, Yerushalmi explains the Torah actually says yielecha twice. And so one of them is yielecha mamon harbe, you get a lot of money. And the other one is the Beit Din can appoint and do appoint people to oversee this. So, but the problem is, if you have the reward mentioned in the Torah, yelecha, you're going to have a lot of money, then why would Beit Din appoint a gardimim? Don't they? Won't we say that they don't coerce on these things? So the Gemara answers, Kaini matnitin, eight bintin shalamala ne'en nashin. The way to read it is, it's not that the Beit Din is not allowed to coerce observance of such mitzvot. It's that the Beit Din is not punished if they don't. In other words, if they want to, they can. So the concept we're saying is, there's not a rule, Beit Din is not allowed to. The rule is, Beit Din is not required to in such situations, but if they see a communal need, such as people want to know that they're getting, you know, the pound of apples, the pound of whatever it is they ordered, so the Beit Din has the right to enforce it, but not the obligation, not the necessity. So, the Chatam Sofer said that's not only because they have the right. The Chatam Sofer says in that situation, actually, he thinks there's an exceptional situation there because there the Torah gives you a positive commandment, but there's also a prohibition of lo tasu avel, that you're not allowed to pervert justice. So, I think the letter writer had said that that he didn't understand why that was a good example because of this prohibition. Chatam Sofer says no, but the prohibition is what they were appointing the people, and they're appointing the people for the assay. So that's a conversation of its own about where Beit Din do and don't. So there's a ritva that says when it comes to tztaka, we coerce people to give tztaka when you had a functioning Beit Din, which is a social reality to think about because I can't imagine it working today. But he says the reason why we do, even though there too, with tztaka, the reward is written in the Torah. And you have this principle, if the reward's written in the Torah, the Beit Din is not required to make sure to enforce observance, but you've got poor people who need it, and therefore the Beit Din would coerce anyway. I'm going to skip a bunch about that issue. Very interesting topic of what we can coerce about and not coerce about. And then the question also is, even if we're going to admit or think that we have the right and the ability to coerce on certain things, this guy had suggested, maybe you need mumchin. You need the kinds of judges who have the original smicha that came down from Moshe Sinai, was in a chain all the way till the chain was broken. Maybe you need that, and therefore we couldn't do it today, right? That ordinary people, which is all Torah scholars today, don't have the right to do that. So the Chasam Sofer says, I think there are two kinds of mitzvahs that we would coerce observance. So kiyum, chukim, or mitzvahs, general observances of Torah law, he thinks that's an issue of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh, that the Jewish people, again, an idea that is spoken about, I think not always recognized, we're all responsible for each other, not in terms of only in terms of taking care of each other, but also in fact that each other's spiritual lives and each other's connection to Hashem, each other's observance of Hashem's mitzvot is a responsibility for all of us, and therefore it's all of us, because the reason why it's usually given to Beit Din, the Chatam Sofer says, because only because they represent the rest of the people. But it's really a function of an obligation on everybody. So if you don't have mumkin, you don't have experts and people qualified by that chain of Misora to do it, so you still got to do it. And therefore, because it's an obligation on everybody, on Kol Adam Yisrael, Katan Vigadol. If you have the ability to do it, you're going to have the responsibility to do it as well. He points out a pasuk by Molech that I think also is worth noticing. The Torah says, in the case of people giving their children to Molech, im halem yalimu ma'aretz b'titzoet mibanav, I think, lamolech. If the nation ignores this person doing Molech worship, so Hashem says he's going to come and punish everybody. So it sounds like It's everybody. And that's so the question is, how far does that go? Right? That's only in Molech situation. Theoretically, you could say, if it's not Molech, you don't have to get involved. Except we have this principle of we also have the principle in the Gemara that if a Talmud, if a student is sitting in front of his Rebbe and somebody does something against the Torah, the student doesn't have to wait for the teacher to protest it or to object to it or to react to it. But you have cases in the Gemara where the students react to it right in front of the Rebbe, and that's not seen as a problem. So when Beit Din does things, they're doing it for us, but it doesn't mean that we don't have the responsibility. So when you have a guy who's violating the Torah, the responsibility to react, says in the Chatzim Sofer, you can't say, well, we don't have Mumukim, we don't have the original Smicha, we can't do it. So we all have the responsibility to take care of these kinds of things if we can. He gives an example that I think is very relevant today as well. Let's say a Beit Din ruled, the proper and appropriate Beit Din ruled that one guy owes another guy money and the guy refuses to do it. Let's say the Beit Din, for whatever reason, is not able to enforce it. He says he thinks every Jewish has the responsibility to do what they can to enforce it. And when the Beit Din, if the Beit Din were to put a guy in Nidoi, and they were to excommunicate a guy, he thinks that's Bishlichut Kol Yisrael. It's supposed to be thought of as representing the entire body of the Jewish people. So there's a little bit more to the tshuva, but it comes back to the fact that this guy says, you know, he thinks that the Beit Din is putting the guy in Nidoi, and they have an obligation to object to this guy's actions, then we don't care about him anymore. So this says, I don't think it's true. The whole point of the Beit Din's actions always is to try to help this person to the extent possible, or other people, come closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to try to remove obstacles and things that will lead other people to sin. And so that's what we're trying to do. So it's always got to be about trying to foster more observance, and since these children are completely innocent because they haven't done anything wrong because they're just children, he thinks, therefore, you have to do what you can to save the children. So for the 11th Nisan of, I didn't say this before, Tuf Kuf Tzadi of 1830, the Chatam Sofer responding to a guy. And the Chatam Sofer, I think, has often been treated as somebody who is so virulently anti-reform and such a kanoi, such a fanatic almost about these issues, or so zealous about these issues that you might have thought that if you have a kid whose father is going the wrong way and is rejecting communal discipline, you might have thought the Chatzos would say, well, what are you going to do? The kids are gone. We've lost them. And yet here, in the face of a letter writer who was suggesting something along those lines, the Chatzos is adamant that is, in fact, not what we can do, that we have to worry about the kids and all the reasons that were given for not, he has gotten rid of. So that is a response of the day. Thank you, OU. Thank you, Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz. Thank you, David Hockhauser. My name is Gideon Lustein, the 11th of Nisan, response of the day. Have a great day.